the Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Welcome back, everybody, to Arthropod, your entomology podcast. We are here today. I am one of your hosts, Jonathan Larson.
It's a stalemate between me and Jody. Jody, you go.
I'm your second host, Jody Green, from the University of Nebraska.
And I'm your third host, bringing up the rear, Michael Scavarla from Penn State.
I forgot the university part. That's why you were staring at me. I'm at University of Kentucky.
Which, if you have been a consistent listener, you will realize that that is something new.
It's a little different. I did move. I switched jobs. I'm now a professor here at the University of Kentucky. Still an extension. Still doing lots of plant stuff, but just a slightly different role. I'm going to be a specialist on campus. That's kind of one of the reasons that we've been on a little bit of a hiatus here this summer is because I had to move my family across the country. But here we are, back again, in the saddle. You two couldn't be more excited.
It's different.
I'm very excited to be back.
Yeah. It is different now because there are three people over the entire half the country, I would say. So we've got a good bit of coverage here. We need to find somebody maybe on the West Coast.
Ooh. Let's do that. That's a great idea.
Okay.
Can we have a casting call? And then we like Skype in and like make faces and ask questions and be like, you will do.
You'll do.
Hey, entomologists on the West Coast, if you want to join Arthropod, send us a headshot and your best 30-second spiel about why you need to be on the show to our Twitter handle, at ArthropodShow. Is that what we are? I don't even remember.
We're really bad at Arthropod Twitter.
Arthro_pod show? Arthropod_show?
We don't even know our Twitter.
Man, if we have a first-time listener that's coming in on this episode, they're going to probably turn us off right here, so.
It's okay.
Yeah, so don't go away. I mean, we have just been on a break, but we're back, and I think we're better because we are covering more, and funnily enough, we're just happy to see each other because we haven't, like, this is the first time I've seen Jonathan's head since June?
I moved in July. You saw me then.
Well, and there's something else kind of going on. All three of us are on Skype now. And there's, you know, it's hard to tell because you have less body cues who's going to talk next.
That's true.
Trying to look at each other on the Skypes when before you two were in a room together so you could play off each other. And there was me in the background trying to chime in edgewise.
We're going to have to come up with some sort of like baseball hand signal thing. It's your turn. It's your turn.
Yeah.
Bunt.
Or just do this enough that we get used to it.
That's true. We do have a slightly new setup. I've got some new equipment, and hopefully we sound a little bit better than we have in the past. Hopefully there's less buzz. We don't usually have insects on the show to help make that buzz. That's electronic interference because of computers. So we hopefully have cleaned that up a little bit. And we're just excited to be back and doing the show again. And we have a really interesting topic for today's episode. We've all been talking about what we want to discuss on the show, and something that kind of came up is autumn caterpillars. That at this time of year, here at the advent of September and into October, we seem to all three end up getting a lot of questions about caterpillars, right?
Yeah, definitely. Especially for me, the thing I see the most, or at least I have seen the most in past years, is hickory tussock moths. So you may not be familiar with them. They are fuzzy and white and black. And I think the biggest reason I see people concerned about them is there have been news stories in the past, and this may be correlated with why I see an uptick and haven't seen them this year, but there's news stories that say, oh, this new invasive poisonous caterpillar is invading from Canada, and it will kill you and your pets.
They always blame Canada.
Right? That's all of that is false. They're native. They're supposed to be here. They won't kill you. They do have detachable hairs that can cause an itch. If you were to just pick it up between your fingers, you might get itchy fingers. If you were to rub that in your eyes, that would also be unpleasant, and you get itchy eyes. I just wrote a fact sheet about it for Penn State, trying to get ahead of it, trying to get people to maybe see that before they freak out. So dove into the literature a bit. There are, when the caterpillars pupate, they incorporate their hairs into their cocoons. So the cocoons are also hairy. And there have been cases where toddlers eat the cocoons and get the hairs all down their throats.
Oh, no.
Yeah, that's terrible.
It is. But even then, even if you eat a caterpillar or a cocoon, it causes salivating, like your throat itches. But it doesn't cause like anaphylactic shock or anything. It just itches. And the couple cases that I've read about, the kids recovered without incident with supportive care. Like, they don't even try to remove the hairs because it's too big of a hassle and will cause more damage than the hairs do. So they just like let the mucus deal with it and flush it through your system. So like there's, aside from some itching, if you like step on one, as far as I can tell, they're not that bad.
So are they barbed or is there venom in it?
It is unclear. They are barbed.
So okay. So that's why they get stuck.
Mm-hmm.
Where do they pupate? In the ground?
Yeah. So they feed up. Primarily feed up in oak trees. And they descend to pupate in the soil, or not in the soil, sorry, in leaf litter. Protected areas, so you get them, like, if you have a log pile for a wood burner, they'll get into the logs and stuff. They'll in like, under siding and places, so if you peel up, like, a piece of bark or look under some siding on a porch, you might find them there.
I think, actually, I didn't know much about the caterpillars, but when I was in Ontario, cottage country, for summer vacation, I did log one of the adults for like moths of Ontario on iNaturalist. It's really pretty.
They are. And they're the adults are attracted to lights at night. So if you know what you're looking for, they're pretty common.
Yeah, they're very common every night.
Yeah, I see them. I've seen them at gas stations, at my own porch light. They're just kind of all over during the right season.
They're like, I don't know, what would you call it? I'm really bad with like colors because I only know like the primary names of the colors.
light tan and white.
See, I would have been like orangish.
Okay, yeah, maybe
all over.
Yeah, but, it could be an orangey.
Yeah, but since we're talking about the caterpillars, so what makes them like? So they must be really attractive if people want to touch them, right?
I don't know if I mean, I think they're pretty, but they're like fuzzy woolly bears, kind of, sort of. Oh,
well, see, that's cute, right?
I think they're cute.
I think a lot of people see a fuzzy caterpillar and they want to know what the fuzz feels like. Like, want to pet fuzzy things.
Yeah.
But not spiders.
Generally
nobody
not.
Nobody wants to touch spiders except for us.
I don't know. Our experiences at home shows and things say otherwise. There's, you know, it's a nice 50-50 split. People want to feel what the tarantula's hair feels like.
Is there a way to tell, like, when you look at a caterpillar, which ones are going to be bad and which ones are going to be good, though? You know, like, generally when we're like, oh, a bright colored insect, that's going to be poisonous, or like, don't touch it. You know, like one of those warning apposematism. Is there something like that for caterpillars?
I generally tell people I say, don't touch any hairy caterpillar. Because the best way to find out is to touch it and see what happens to your hand afterwards. But barring that, I think there are some differences in the way that the spines or the hairs may look, or if you can recognize certain families, you will be able to tell the difference. But if you haven't looked that kind of information up and you're just heading out into the woods for a hike and you see a fuzzy caterpillar, take a picture with your phone, observe it from afar, but it's best not to mess with it.
Yeah, like thinking of things like monkey slugs and pus moth caterpillars, like they're just drab brown. Like you would be just as likely to accidentally brush up against it because you didn't see it. And then, you know, they're some of the most painful caterpillar stings, at least in the United States. So
yeah, talk about that.
Oh,
the first time I looked at a pus caterpillar, I'm like, I don't even know what that is. That looks like somebody's eyebrow. Or, like, I do not want to know what that is, you know? Like, I would not have touched it.
It looks like a toupee.
Yes.
Like, it really does. It looks like you took off somebody's toupee, shrunk it down, and slapped it on a leaf.
And gave it mandibles.
Oh, sure. And teeny tiny legs, because they've got reduced prolegs, which is kind of cool. And monkey slugs are similar, except they've got, like, crazy, like, six crazy arms that come off the body. Honestly, I've only ever had one monkey slug turned in for ID. I've never seen a pus moth, so I don't know a whole heck of a lot about them, except that the stings are stupid painful.
Can you find them here?
Yeah, they at least in the east, I know we have them. I'm not sure how far west they get, if you would see them.
How about saddlebacks? Have you ever gotten one of those brought in?
Photos only.
Yeah. So saddlebacks, they're like bright green with a brown saddle in the middle on the back. And they have really pointy looking hairs on their body. That's supposed to be really nasty. I've never experienced it, but I've heard tales of how painful it is.
Yeah. Yeah, in general, if the caterpillar is very fuzzy or if you see obvious sharp pointy spines, that's another no touch. Well, I grabbed an Iomoth caterpillar as a teenager. That was less than pleasant.
Right.
They're pretty bad too.
Can you describe it for our listeners? Like, I'm gonna guess most of them haven't experienced it.
Geez, that was half a lifetime ago.
It's an audio platform. You can really describe physical sensations pretty well.
Oh no, I know. I'm just trying to remember.
I'm just kidding.
Honestly, the details are gone because it was I was 15 and I'm 33 now. It was, you know.
Okay, 18. I'm looking at a picture. Do you want me to describe it?
Yeah, use a picture.
It looks like something that you would, like, it would be really good to clean the inside of a test tube. Like, it's really bristly. It's, like, this really fascinating bright light green. And on the sides, it's got, like, a white and pink stripe together. So it kind of looks like bacon. So, I don't know. It looks like a green, bristly, fuzzy caterpillar with, like, suction cup bristles and bacon on the sides. Like, I would want to pick it up, probably.
Yeah. Sorry, like I thought you meant describing the pain.
That's what I wanted, but I also appreciate description of it.
Because she said it bacon. No, I appreciate the description, too. They're really pretty. They look like something you might want to pick up, but, yeah, I just remember there being an intense pain. I don't remember the details of it because it was so long ago.
I've also met some folks here that have been stung by flannel moths. That has been a few occurrences here in Kentucky that I've heard about. It's also a brightly colored caterpillar. They get their name because they look like they have kind of a sort of spotted flannel-like appearance, but that's also an uncomfortable feeling if you brush up against one of them and the urticating hairs get stuck in you.
Like the moth itself?
The caterpillar.
Okay.
It says here that after about 15 minutes, three white blisters appeared that lasted 2 hours, burning the whole time, but gradually diminishing in intensity. After the blisters disappeared, the itching lasted another several hours and the redness until the next morning. Doesn't sound great.
Yikes. Is that like a type of pus caterpillar?
Yeah, I think so.
Because of that... moth. Well, the reason I asked if the moth did, because that moth is like super fuzzy, like it is wearing like five layers of flannel. So that's why I think that. I mean,
so I think we've established there are much, much worse caterpillars out there than hickory tussock moths, which don't pick up, don't rub them in your eyes, but they're also not gonna like kill you like people think they are.
Same precautions you would take with fiberglass.
Actually, That's not the worst example. That may actually even be a good example.
That wasn't the worst compliment I've ever received. So I think that's one reason that people ask a lot of questions about caterpillars here in the fall is that they have heard that some of the ones that we see large and active at this time of year are part of a group that can cause them some pain. So I think that's one reason that folks are asking questions, especially when they see big fuzzy ones. So that was like the first group you mentioned. Are there any others that we commonly encounter as a group?
I often get a number of giant silk moths, particularly imperial moths and regal moths that people turn in. I actually got called by a local-ish newspaper about people finding imperial moth caterpillars in a state park nearby. because they're also kind of spiny. Not to the level of like some other caterpillars, but they're like 4 inches long, and people see this giant green hot dog crawling across the ground, get very concerned. I had one woman call me because she found two of them in her yard and was worried about her small dogs.
That they were going to eat them and get sick?
I guess, or that the caterpillars were attack her dogs. I'm not quite sure.
That they're that big or the dog is that small?
Probably both. And people see them this time of year because the caterpillars pupate in the soil, so they're up feeding in the trees all summer, and now it's getting time to overwinter, and they come down and they're crawling around looking for some loose soil to dig into and make a pupal chamber and turn into a pupa. And so, you know, while these caterpillars have been around most of the summer, people are just now seeing them because they're out wandering about. But yeah, so I've gotten a bunch of calls about them as well, which is kind of, I've never seen one. I would love to see a giant 4-inch caterpillar.
It'd make my day.
Right?
I've never seen one either. I've only actually been shown a picture of the moth once this year. But they actually look kind of like the hungry caterpillar.
Yeah.
The very hungry caterpillar. Like, that's actually what it looks like. I did have a call with someone also about worried about their dogs and caterpillars. I think they were fall webworms though, and they were coming down out of the tree. So they've been dropping a lot of silk and coming down, and he was worried his dog was going to eat them and die. And yeah, he also blamed Canada. So I think I need to forward him your fact sheet.
Standard operating procedure here in the United States, Jody, is to blame your home nation. I get a lot of questions around this time of year about fall webworm. Back when I was in Nebraska, and I've gotten several since I moved here to Kentucky. I think that in Kentucky, there's an added layer of worry about webworms in general in trees, because the eastern tent caterpillar is what has been blamed for what's called reproductive mare loss syndrome, or mare reproductive loss syndrome, where there was an outbreak of tent caterpillars about 10 years ago, if I remember the story correctly, and or maybe even 15. And the caterpillars were coming down out of trees, the mares were eating them, and foals were being aborted because of all the hairs that were being ingested by the horses. This is the reasoning that has been listed, at least in several publications. So there's lots of people that are very jumpy about seeing tents in their trees, even if it's just the fall webworm rather than the eastern tent caterpillar.
That's really weird, because the tents appear at different times of the year. Like, tent caterpillars are a spring, early summer thing,
right,
and fall webworms are obviously out in the late summer and fall.
We have seen the fall webworms creep up sometimes, I think. I've seen them appear as early as June, which seems kind of nuts to me for something named the fall webworm, but it is something that can pop up a little earlier. Thanks, climate change.
Well, I thought maybe isn't there two generations too in some places? So, because I see them early and then I see them in fall as well.
Okay.
But the difference is like something about the crotch of the tree, right? Like,
right,
there aren't the tent caterpillars more in the crotch of the branches, and fall webworms is more at the end?
Right. Fall webworms web over the tip of the branch to feed in that newer growth, while the earlier season ones, they are down in the crooks of the branch, the crotch of the branch. They have a compact nest there that they go out from and feed.
So what do you tell people to do about those? Like, I think yesterday I told people to break up the webs.
Yeah,
let them
come
down.
I think that's the best thing to do. It's hard to spray for them because they're so protected in those web nests. If you can get a stick up into it and twirl it like a cotton candy machine person, then pull it out and throw it on the ground, that's a really good way to deal with those particular pests. You can prune them out if they're at the tip of the branch rather than down in the crotch, so that you can get rid of them. The worst thing to do is fire. I don't know if either of you have ever seen people use fire for these particular pests, but it's a bad idea because you have a bunch of crispy leaves, you have a bunch of webbing, and you're just going to burn your tree and ruin it. So please do not use fire. It is not a great pest control tool.
When it comes to the mare reproductive loss, though, do you want to get, like, move those caterpillars away so that they don't get into the, you know, like...
Okay, I'm going to speak like from a very not, I don't know everything there is to know about what happened during that time, just that there was a record outbreak of the tent caterpillars that year, and that they were in cherry trees, and that cherry trees are apparently really common on horse farms, and that the caterpillars were falling out of the trees and being eaten by the horses in the grass under the trees. So I think that there were people doing systemic treatments then to try and knock out the tent caterpillars really quickly. And there is some efficacy for using a systemic soil drench on these kinds of plants to protect them from those caterpillars. But I don't think that's something you want to do every year. It's something that we would reserve for those kinds of emergency, quote unquote, situations.
Well, in, in both species are native, so they're often controlled by parasitoids.
Yeah.
In you know, you might get an outbreak of fall webworm one year, but the next year they're not there. They're at low levels because the parasitoids have caught up and, you know, hammered them back.
I think I read something the other day that fall webworm is considered a nursery species for parasitoids. Like, it has so many parasitoids that it's just like a living nursery for that group of wasps. It,
if I remember correctly, it's something like 50 species of parasitoids attack them.
That's nuts.
Yeah, it's an outrageous number, which is also a reason you don't want to use like broad spectrum insecticides on them.
Yeah, exactly. You don't want to knock those out.
No, you're at more of a risk of causing a worse outbreak because you kill all your parasitoids.
So definitely those tent caterpillars pop up and the webworms pop up. There's another one, mimosa webworm, that I remember being a big deal out in Nebraska. Is it still a problem, Jody?
It is for people that have honey locust trees. So, same thing.
Yeah, it's kind of webbing over parts of those branches and eating up those. And locust trees are really popular. I'm not sure why, but people really like to plant them. So we see a lot of those caterpillars. Yeah.
And right now, because it's, you know, starting to be fall and we've got a lot of spiders, people are confused as are these like spider webs or are these caterpillars? So it's, you know, you don't think you would get those two confused, but there's so much silk and webbing in the tree that you don't know what it is. So people are kind of freaked out as to what's in there. If they could reach it sometimes and open it up, they would just see like hundreds of caterpillars and like lots of poop. So even when you're doing your cotton candy webbing thing, you want to be careful under there.
Yeah, you don't want to get caterpillar poop in your eye, I guess.
In your eye.
Can I list one more that I hear a lot of questions on? A lot of questions about woolly bears out here in Kentucky. I remember that from back when I was a grad student here. I also remember it now because I've gotten some of those. It's a really cool species of caterpillar, overwinters as a larva. And it has a bit of a legend attached to it, right, Jody?
It has a huge legend to it. And I think that's what makes me sad, maybe about like these don't touch me caterpillars. Because like woolly bears, like, you know, when you see a woolly bear, it's probably one of the most recognized caterpillars, I think. And you pick it up. And so now I'm like, now I'm going to have to refrain from picking up all caterpillars to teach lessons. But it's not one of those that have, you know, urticating hairs or is going to be harmful if you pick it up. But evidently, which has been debunked, it was able to tell the weather, particularly how harsh a winter was going to be.
And I think that you can use it maybe as a teaching tool to show people like there are bad stinging caterpillars, but this group we can handle sort of with impunity. Would you say that's fair, Mike? Like the tiger moths, the salt marsh tiger moths? You don't really have to worry about.
Yeah, because they don't have venom. The hairs, like Jody said, don't urticate. They don't come out. I mean, don't obviously put it under your foot and step on it barefooted. That would probably hurt, I imagine.
Don't eat them.
Don't eat them. They are spiny, but yeah, you can pick them up, like you said, with impunity, and there's no risk there.
And they're recognizable. I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, there's a couple different species, but they all more or less look the same, like the black or black and brown body plan.
Right. So Jody mentioned that this was originally believed to be able to tell the weather, to tell you how bad of a winter it was going to be. I was reading a National Weather Service publication about this whole phenomenon, and there were parts of it that I didn't even know. I didn't recall hearing these before. Apparently, there are traditionally considered to be 13 weeks of winter, and the woolly bear has 13
segments.
Body segments. So each segment is supposed to be predictive of a week of weather, and the bigger the brown part in the middle, the less harsh the winter is going to be. The more black, the worse it is. Right, Jody?
Right. But then there's also some other stuff. Like if you see them crossing the road, because they usually are, and they're heading south, that means it's going to be a bad winter as well, because they're trying to get away from the cold.
Yeah. One of my favorite things I read was, okay, so if it's the band in the middle, there's also sometimes where one of the black bands is longer than the other one. So that tells you which half of the winter is going to be bad, I was reading. And then, yeah, this part about if they're going north, it means it's not going to be so bad up north. Let's all go north and hang out. It's great. We'll catch a Yankees game. It's perfect. If they're going south, though, it means it's time to go to Florida. It's time to escape the cold. And that there's also some people would say that they were woolier overall in cold years, like that the hair was longer, like they had more of a poodle appearance. But all of these have been fairly well debunked. There is no efficacy to predicting the weather with a woolly bear, unfortunately. That doesn't mean it doesn't persist or that they're not popular. I know right here in Kentucky, over in Beattyville, there is a woolly bear festival every year that you can attend to celebrate this wonderful caterpillar.
There are actually many festivals throughout the Midwest there. There's one close to you, probably, Mike. It's in like Lewisburg. Do you know where that is?
Maybe. I believe I've heard that name. I don't know where it's at, though.
Is there Oil City? Is that one?
Yeah, that's out west.
Well, then maybe you have two festivals, if that's not the same. Because, and then there's like a huge one in Ohio, close to Cleveland. There's one in North Carolina. There's some in Ontario. One in New York. So of the three of us, my state does not have a woolly bear festival. I feel ripped off.
Yeah, you should.
You could start one.
I need a reason to party over a caterpillar.
I would really like to see at these festivals that there's like a Mr. Woolly Bear crowned every year, and it's somebody with like the biggest, bushiest beard, or you have to like dye it different colors to get that winter predictiveness going.
Oh, you said beard. I assumed it would have been a big mustache.
Or that? Yeah, actually, that's a better idea. Good call.
I think it just goes to show, though, like if somebody, because I think... it was an insect curator in like 1948. The reason I know this is because I was actually recently interviewed for a woolly bear interview. Okay. I think his name is like Dr. Curran. But like when something gets out, no matter how much actual research was or science was in it, or, you know, the sample size, or, you know, if it gets in the news or gets somewhere and it gets popular, then it takes over and it becomes like this legend. So whether it's got a lot of science behind it or not, whatever, you know, the importance of media and how it takes off. And I mean, but if you want to have a festival, like I'm all for festivals.
So fair foods are great.
You want to celebrate it? That's fine.
Who cares about the truth? As long as I can have elephant ears.
Well, they're good. Common caterpillar found in yards, and kids like them. So, I mean, there's other non-weather related reasons to celebrate the woolly bears.
I agree. They're very handsome.
They are.
So we've talked.
And they feed on like a lot of things, and they're low to the ground, right? So like kids can see them. I know that I had a friend who was running in Kansas once, and she likes to save worms and caterpillars. Like there were hundreds and thousands of woolly bears crossing the road on these country roads, and she was trying to save everyone. We finally had to get her in a car, and I think she had to drop because it was too many.
Too many caterpillars.
Too many caterpillars.
So we've talked about the stinging that we can encounter. We've talked about a few of the different common kinds people may encounter in the autumn. Danger, woolly bears. Why is this happening, though? Like, if we were going to give a primer on why are people seeing so many caterpillars here in the fall, I think Mike kind of talked a little bit about it, but why is it so much more common right now to encounter them?
Well, I think for one, they've had all summer to mature. So if it's a single univoltine species, so something that only has a single generation a year, and they overwinter as pupae or as cocoons, now's the time that they're going to be mature and the biggest they're going to get. So they're, you know, they've been around all year, but maybe they've been too small for people to see, but now they're big. Same thing that happens with fall spiders, like those orb weavers you see. They've been around all year, but now they're adults and big and on your window, so you see them. But also, because they're mature and a lot of butterflies and moths do overwinter as pupae, you know, they're out looking for a protected place to hibernate. So they're crawling, you know, before they would have been on host just munching away, but now they're actively crawling about and searching for protected places. So we see them crossing the road or crossing your lawn or out and about.
Yeah, some of them are looking for that place to pupate. You mentioned like finding a nice snug place in the soil to spin your cocoon or to pupate. I think it's also some of them are going to overwinter as larvae. Is that correct? Mm-hmm.
So the woolly bear.
The woolly bear is a good example. A few others. So they're also looking for a nice snug place to kind of wait out the winter. So they're big. They're obvious. They're moving in places that we may be more likely to look, like down on the sidewalk or down on paved areas, rather than high up in the trees where we couldn't see them before. So it's not an invasion. It's not a super infestation. It's just natural. They're getting away from each other. They don't want to. I think there's something to be said for, like, you want to get out of the way of everybody eating the leaves, too. And you want to go pupate somewhere else because you could just glue yourself to the tree if you were feeling lazy. But otherwise, it's best to get out of there.
Right. And all the webworms or the tent caterpillars, like, they're all, they feed, like, gregariously together. When they're ready to pupate, they're going to move away from each other and come out, right? Yep. So people are going to see them moving around where they probably didn't think about it before. And I think another thing is people don't realize that, like, even the, you know, the beautiful moths or beautiful butterflies, as larvae, they're all destructive, right? They all need to feed on something. So you can't have this beautiful butterfly or this beautiful moth survive if you're going to kill all the caterpillars. Right. So, and that's where their food is. It's going to be through the growing season. We're growing them, our gardens and our vegetables and fruit trees, and that's their food too. So, you know, at the end of the summer, we're harvesting and they're full. So
it's just like the almost end of the hungry, hungry caterpillar.
Yep. Just chocolate cake.
Yes. They've eaten all that stuff, the sausage, the cake, the lollipop. They got a bite of leaf. Now they turn into a big brown cocoon or pupa. Right. So there's lots of different reasons why we're seeing it, lots of different kinds out there that people can encounter. If you were to give some folks advice, either one of you can go first on this, about like where to look to help for identification, maybe they can contact us as extension entomologists, but there are also lots of good caterpillar resources out there. So where do the experts turn to if they are trying to identify a caterpillar, Mike?
I am awful at caterpillar ID.
Me too.
I'm so bad. Unless it's like an imperial moth or hickory tussock moth that I've seen 1,000 times at this point. Honestly, the place I go to often is iNaturalist. If somebody sends me a really good caterpillar photo, the AI that iNaturalist uses is often very good at identifying them because, you know, caterpillars are often large enough to be photographed well with a cell phone. They often have bold patterns, and it's the kind of insect that an AI identification does really well at. So oftentimes, if I don't know what it is right off the bat, rather than flipping through a book first, I'll upload it to iNaturalist and see what they suggest it is. And then, of course, double check, because some caterpillars look very similar and the AI gets confused. But that's a good first place. If you're in the eastern United States, there's a really good book about eastern caterpillars. And so if I, Jody has it. Does that work well? And John does too. Mine's over on my shelf, so I can't show them. does that work well out in Nebraska, or is that getting too far west?
Well, okay, so this one's The Caterpillars of Eastern North America, David L. Wagner. I like it, but I agree with you for iNaturalist as like a first step. And then, but I like it. I don't know. Sometimes it's difficult, I would say, for non-entomologists to start, you know, to begin to start. Because for us, like, we'll know, oh, this is a brush-footed butterfly, you know, we'll know our family, so we'll narrow it down. But I like it. It's not bad for Nebraska still. So
yeah, I had one, just to go off that, I had somebody send photos of question mark caterpillars in that they were feeding on some hops plants. And I looked at it, and at first I thought it was a mourning cloak, and then realized, no, it's not a mourning cloak. But it was like, this is some kind of nymphalid. I don't know what, but it's definitely an emphalus. So then I just flipped through the caterpillar book, like, oh, there it is. It's a question mark.
Yeah, but you know what? That one's so hard. Like, I think the reason why, and I think Jonathan and I have had this in the past, like, why we hate sometimes having to identify, like, the Lepidopteran larvae is because, I mean, how many instars of caterpillars do they go through? And they can look so different at each stage. So, like, that mature caterpillar that looks really cool and can be easily identified, whereas, like, second, third, fourth instar, they could all be different. Like, you just think of even the, like, the black swallowtail, right? How they look very bird poopish and brown with a white blotch, and then over time they've got this green and black and yellow, and it's just different every time. But do you want me to go where I would go? Okay. So iNaturalist for sure, best app. I think it's great. I think I love it. And then after, I would check with like Bug Guide. I like my book. If I also like the Butterflies and Moths of North America. It's like butterfliesandmoths.org, and they've got the map there as well. Similar to iNaturalist. And so there's a bunch of different pictures, and I think that's pretty neat, of the adult and the caterpillars at different life stages. And then for Nebraska, there is on the Nebraska Game and Parks, they'll talk about the most common butterflies and moths. So it's fun to have something, you know, local, you know, what people are seeing a lot. I like different parks that have like their own little brochures. It's always nice to know, like, what the parks are seeing and what brochures they have, so you can talk more about them in depth where people can't get those. So,
I'll second Bug Guide and Moths and Butterflies, and also the Moth Photographer Group website. Yeah. They're really good, but I tend to use them after I know what a thing is,
right?
Because they've got a bunch of information about host plants and when they're out and range maps, but they're more difficult to use if you're like, I don't know what this thing is, where do I start? They're not great for that, but they've got more information than a lot of the other resources like iNaturalist. So
yeah,
like I'll use something else to figure out what they are and then jump over to those websites to fill in the details.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, there's a lot of great resources out there. You just need to know how to use them and the order to use them, and just make sure you write down maybe the scientific name, which you might not know, and then plug that into another search engine, and then you'll get more information that way. So
definitely. Yeah. I think honestly, that's the biggest, maybe not aspect of our jobs, is just like the information's out there. Just, it's very difficult sometimes for people to know how to get it easily. And right. So our job is like, well, I know I can go to this book, this website, and this other resource and bring it all together for people and tell them what's in these places.
Yeah.
I know, like, what to Google.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah. You just know where to find things. Or, I mean, even if for people that are on Facebook, there are so many entomology related groups, right? There's the entomology group, but there's like a moth and butterfly group. There's a caterpillar group. So you can join one of those groups. And even if you don't want to post your own picture, just like scroll down and just see the amount of caterpillars that get put there. And there are often, I guess, you know, rules and experts on there that can identify it for you.
So there you go. Turn to some of those different websites if you have a basic idea of what it is you're looking at. Things like Bug Guide, iNaturalist, Moths and Butterflies of the U.S., Moth Photographers Group. Lots of different resources are out there that can help with this. You can always contact your local extension service, and they are either going to know what it is or they're going to know who is going to know. But it's a lot of fun to look through some of these books. It's a lot of fun to try and plant plants for caterpillars or to try and rear them. Hopefully you all enjoy seeing them out in the autumn right now and leave them be, so just for your safety, but as well for their safety so they can get where they're going. And maybe if you can give them a helping hand like Jody's friend every now and then, they can find a nice place to hide out for the winter and we can see some moths next year. Anything else to add to today's show, everybody?
Sorry. I miss you, Jonathan.
I miss all of you. I'm glad that Arthropod is back and that we have a reason to hang out and to provide all kinds of educational entertainment for people's ear holes.
We've got the next, the next three episodes planned out right now. But if you, the listeners, have any content you want covered, any questions you'd like us to get to, We've got places that you can contact us. John, what are our contacts?
You can always go to our blogspot, arthro-pod.blogspot.com, and you can find our whole archive there. You can reach us through the Gmail account that is associated with that blogspot as well. You can find each of us individually on Twitter. I am at BugmanJohn. Now that's my new Twitter handle. Yeah.
I'm at JodyBugsMeUNL.
And I'm at MScavarlo36. If any of the listeners can come up with a better handle for me too, I am all ears, because that needs to change.
I will send you my list.
I need something more insect related, I guess.
If you want to send it directly to the show on Twitter, we are at @arthro_podshow on the Tweet Pals. That is how you can find the show there. You can also find us on iTunes. You can find us on Stitcher, any of those different podcatching apps that are out there. If you want to support the show, we don't need any money. We do all of this for free. We would appreciate if you left a kind review and some stars for us. That would be great to let us know how we're doing, or to send us those ideas you have for future shows.
Unless it's a one star, don't give us those.
I mean, no, you can be honest with us. We've got one of those or two of those out there. We appreciate
it. Just tell us how to make it better.
Oh.
Thank you for joining us, and we will catch you next time on Arthropod.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time, same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.
We did it. It was a podcast.
Yay!